Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing wonderful.
It's nice to see so many of you this afternoon. Oh, it's kind of a gloomy day out. But we appreciate you joining us. All right, well, I'm going to introduce myself in a little bit. So I'm going to hand it over to Ms. Katie Kelly, our Assistant Director of the Program for Instructional Excellence, and she will start us off.
All right. Hi there, everybody. Can you see a PowerPoint slide before I jump right into it? Cool. I see nodding.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here today at our first virtual workshop of the spring 2021 semester. Today, we're going to be talking about leading online discussion, general tips and tricks and strategies you can use in the classroom. And I do like to give a little disclaimer that even though we're talking about online discussions, since that's what is most relevant at the moment, a lot of these tips you can transfer over to the face-to-face classroom as well. So before we dive right into the session, I just want to give a few general Zoom session guidelines. First, when you're not speaking, please mute your microphone. Be aware that if you have your camera or your mic turned on, other participants may be able to see or hear you as well as what's in your background. If you have any trouble seeing our screen share, you can try selecting the gallery view on Zoom, and that should shift things around a little bit. If you do have a question or would like to make a comment, you can use the chat function in Zoom, or you can raise your hand to let us know that you'd like to say something. And lastly, please just silence your phone and email as other participants may be able to hear notifications. So, without further ado, my name is Katie Kelly, and I am the Assistant Director for the Program for Instructional Excellence and the Fellows Society here at FSU. If you've never been to any of our workshop sessions, first of all, it's great to have you. Thank you for coming. But I am a two-time FSU alumnus. I have my bachelor's in psychology and my master's in instructional systems and learning technologies. So a lot of what I'm talking about today comes from my work in the instructional design field, as well as my work as an online TA. So now I'll hand it over to our director.
Thank you, Katie. I'm Dr. Lisa Liceno, and I'm the director, as Katie said, of the Program for Instructional Excellence. I am also an assistant dean in the graduate school, and I direct the Fellows Society, which is an honor society for grad students who hold prestigious fellowships and awards. And I am also currently the faculty advisor for the Diversity and Inclusion in Research and Teaching organization here at FSU. I did receive my PhD in philosophy from FSU back in 2007. And so I still continue to teach philosophy classes. And I also worked for 7 years in undergrad studies in the Academic Center for Excellence as a faculty member. So I go back to, I reach back to the things I learned in the Learning Center there. In my role as the director for PI, too.
All right, so getting into the agenda for today, we will explore tips and styles for creating and facilitating asynchronous online discussions in the classroom, explore techniques for facilitating effective synchronous discussion sessions, and we will discuss discussion techniques that you might utilize in your online classroom. So when we talk about discussion, especially now that we are delving into the world of distance learning, there are two major types that you'll often see in the classroom. The first is asynchronous, which in this presentation, I'll divide into two different styles. I have single prompt style and multiple prompt style, and we'll get into a little bit more about what those mean shortly. But that's the idea, of course, that people are participating usually in a distance learning setting at different times of the day throughout the week. You usually have a discussion period of a few days or of a solid week where people have the chance to post on some sort of online forum. And then we have synchronous discussions, and the primary tool we're using to do that at FSU is Zoom. And that, of course, is where people are discussing in real time, not necessarily in the same place, because while FSU does have things like flex classes and a few in-person labs going on at the moment, most of our classes we see are still being held online through Zoom. So before we get too much into the styles of asynchronous and synchronous discussion, I do want to point out this Bloom's taxonomy photo. If you've been to any of the other workshops that I have facilitated, you'll know I use this picture almost every single time because it is such a helpful tool for so many aspects of designing instruction and facilitating an effective classroom. Now, if you've never seen Bloom's taxonomy, in short, it is a hierarchy of learning tasks that range from lower level cognition tasks at the bottom of the pyramid and gradually increase in complexity as we move up the pyramid. So whatever learning objectives you have, the complexity of those learning objectives, you can sort of see the spectrum if you look at it in terms of this taxonomy. Now, when we're designing discussions, the reason I bring Bloom's taxonomy into our topic today is because we want to stay away from that bottom tier, which states remember. And that's because at the remember tier, students are doing things like memorizing rules and basic concepts, and they're defining terminology. It's something that is a very low level of cognition that sets a foundation for whatever they're talking about, but it's not really conducive to discussion because they're doing a lot of rote memorization tasks. This is something that'd be more appropriate for a quiz or a test or some kind of short write-up assignment, but not really a discussion. Whereas when we move up the tiers of Bloom's taxonomy and gradually get a little bit more complex in the types of cognition we're going for, you can see in the middle we have apply and analyze, and that's where students are solving and demonstrating things. They're organizing and differentiating information. They're doing tasks that are not extremely complex, but complex enough to facilitate a good critical thinking discussion. So essentially, in a nutshell, the point of all this is keep in mind the objectives you have for your discussion and kind of think back to this Bloom's taxonomy as a tool to help you figure out if your goals are conducive to a good discussion. All right, so diving into the two different styles of asynchronous discussion, we will first discuss the single prompt style. And this is the style of discussion that I tend to see most often in online classrooms. It is the discussion style in which the instructor creates one single discussion prompt to which students all generate a response. Usually the discussion prompt has multiple parts to it, so it is a question that is fairly lengthy and complex and requires a substantial amount of work for students to participate. But the defining feature is that everyone is answering the exact same question. A lot of instructors like to use this function on Canvas in the settings that states users must post before seeing replies. And this means that when a student clicks on the discussion prompt, they will not see anything that any other student has written until they first post their own response. And this is really helpful because if you're worried that students might just read what other students have posted and try to cobble together a response from that rather than reading the material and doing their own work, this can help to prevent that. So one thing that is very important that I'm going to say multiple times as we talk about these different discussion techniques is making sure that you have clear requirements and deadlines for participation. This is really, really crucial in asynchronous discussion because students tend to have a lot of questions about, you know, how often am I expected to post? What is the deadline for making my first post? Am I supposed to respond to other people? So whatever you as the instructor decide constitutes a satisfactory response on behalf of the students engaging in the discussion, make sure you just write very, very clear instructions for that. And I'll have a couple of examples of clear instructions that you can use. So here's an example of a single prompt style of discussion. This is actually from a sample course I created. It doesn't have any students enrolled in it, so there's no FERPA concerns. But here for my sample single prompt, I have the discussion is divided into two portions, an initial response to the prompt and a minimum of two peer responses. You must participate on at least two separate days this week. The initial prompt is due by Wednesday of this week. The two peer responses are due by Sunday of next week. And these instructions highlight some major questions that students will probably have, especially if they have never engaged in an asynchronous discussion before. It tells them how many responses they're supposed to make. It tells them the time period throughout the week and if they're expected to participate on multiple days. And it tells them when the initial prompt is due and when the peer responses are due. I know this may seem like a little bit of overkill with all of the instructions I've written out, but trust me, it will save you a lot of trouble if you over-explain what students are meant to do as opposed to under-explaining. All right, so next we have the second style of asynchronous discussion, which I like to call multiple prompt style. And personally, this is my favorite style of discussion that I've seen instructors use in the online classroom. This is where the instructor creates several different discussion prompt options and allows the students to choose which topics that week are particularly interesting to them, and they can pursue those threads of discussion in the forum and really focus on the things that stood out to them as a unique learner in the classroom. Now, the way you do this, there are a couple different styles you can use depending on your preference for how you set up your Canvas course. But the way I typically do it is to use that space that instructors usually write the prompt itself to write the instructions. Then I reply to that as if I'm responding as a student, and I put those responses in my replies. Now I have screenshots here, but because we have a little bit more time in this iteration of the workshop, I'd like to actually show you my sample Canvas site that I have. So let me pull that up really quick. Okay. So here's my sample Canvas site. I'm in the discussion section. And all I did to set up this multiple prompt style of discussion is I wrote out all of my instructions here. So I have that students have to create at least one initial post. I have when it's due, the discussion period throughout the week, and I have that they have to respond to at least one of their peers. I've also written out clear instructions regarding what constitutes a good response to a peer, because one thing that you can run into in the discussion forum is students think that a peer response is them saying, "I agree," or "you did a great job with this post." That's really not an effective peer response. So instead, I like to put an explanation that a satisfactory response to a peer's post is something that expands upon the discussion that they're having, or, you know, asks questions or makes critiques or gives alternate perspectives. It's something that grows the thread as opposed to just stopping the discussion right there. But the way I set this up is I just wrote out my instructions in this little box here in the discussion section of Canvas. I published it and then I hit reply. And then here I posted each of my individual prompts. So I have some of them based on the materials I wrote. Here's one down here where I say compare and contrast master's programs, doctorate programs, and other forms of higher education. Which type of program appeals most to your interests and career goals and why? And the reason why I like this particular style of discussion so much is that it really encourages students to engage in exploratory learning and to apply whatever material you're discussing to their own lives, which can really help them to get a little bit more motivated and to see the relevance of what you're talking about. So let me switch back to my PowerPoint really quick. So there are a few general do's and don'ts for asynchronous discussion. I say these are general because I know for a lot of your classes, you're all coming from very different fields and different backgrounds. So what works for discussion in one field may be a little bit different than what works in another field. So these are things that are very general in nature and should be applicable regardless of what you are discussing. So first in the do column, as I've mentioned, we want to make sure that all of the instructions for satisfactory participation are clear. Really make sure you touch upon those points of, you know, what is a good discussion post look like? How many times do they have to post throughout the week? When is the initial post due? Things like that to avoid, you know, getting a lot of emails with these types of questions. If you are a TA who is serving primarily as a grader in your class and you don't actually get to create the discussions, make sure that you assess their participation based on whatever instructions or criteria has been provided for a satisfactory discussion post. And this will help to make sure that as you're grading, everything is consistent and objective based on the rubrics and criteria that have been established for discussion. If you do have a lot of novices to the online learning environment, which you can gauge pretty quickly just by asking your students at the beginning of the semester if they have any experience with online learning, it can often be helpful to have a model of a good discussion post. So you could post a sample question and then you post what a good response to that question looks like. And that can be really helpful to some of the students who need a little bit more scaffolding and guidance as they get into their online classes. It is good to show some involvement in the discussion forum, depending on how much guidance your students need. This sort of gets at the idea of analyzing your unique audience, because every class you have is going to have unique individuals with unique needs in it. So you may have one class where the students are really confident and they know how to interact in the discussion forum and they don't really need much instructor input, but you may have others where students are a little bit more timid and aren't sure what to do. And this is where you can kind of gauge how involved you need to be in the forum. Now, there is some research to show that instructors who are a little bit too involved in the forum, and by too involved, I mean every time a student posts something, the instructor responds to that post. That can sort of lead to students tending to not participate as much in the discussion, or sometimes they focus on the instructor and responding to the instructor as opposed to each other. So that we want to try to avoid that, but it is really important that you do make your presence known in the discussion board. Maybe you make a comment on a couple of students' posts, or maybe you ask a question and encourage someone to elaborate on a particular post. And this helps to reduce some of that isolation that students can be feeling in the online classroom, and it reminds them that you, as the instructor, are still present in the online forum. Whatever discussion technology you're using, usually Canvas in this case, make sure you link to tech support in case students are having issues, they'll know where to go for help. And it's also good to link to netiquette and online civility guidelines, which typically you'll put those in your course syllabus, but it can't hurt to just give them a little reminder to practice netiquette and civility while they are talking to each other online. In the don't category, as I mentioned, we just want to avoid dominating the discussion and being too active, because really discussion is all about getting students to talk with each other and get into those critical thinking talks where they're really applying and dissecting the information. Avoid discussing sensitive information such as grades with the discussion board. Make sure you adhere to all of the university policies on that information. You can find information about that at the university registrar's office. And lastly, I like to tell people from an instructional design perspective, not to overcomplicate the discussion tool that you use in your classroom. You want to use a tool that fulfills your students' needs and fulfills whatever goals you are going for with your instructor. With your lesson and your discussion that day. This sort of gets at the idea of a model that I studied in my instructional design courses called the technology acceptance model. And It states very briefly that successful implementation and adoption of a piece of technology has a tendency to depend on the users of that technology feeling that it is something they can easily learn how to use, and it's something that achieves whatever the goals are of implementing that technology. So this is why I say try not to overcomplicate whatever discussion tool you use, because you don't want the tool itself to interfere with their learning of the content. All right, so we're going to switch gears a little bit and get into synchronous discussion. As I mentioned before, you'll most likely be using Zoom integrated into your Canvas course to host your synchronous discussions. And this is because FSU Zoom is compliant with FERPA and HIPAA, and it has a lot of high security if you use those security settings. Synchronous discussion is good for a lot of things. I find it's especially good for review sessions or summarizing the main points of a particular unit. Maybe you have some major takeaways that you've been having your students learn about asynchronously, and you want to bring them all together in a synchronous space to talk about those main takeaways. This is a really good tool and method for doing that. And it's also good for any activities that are better performed live. I worked for one instructor as an instructional design intern a couple of years ago, who actually liked to use the Zoom sessions to get students to consult their materials in real time and give answers to discussions right then and there. It was something that showed this instructor that they knew where to go in real time to find the information they needed. So some activity like that, where you really need to be able to see what they're doing and how they're coming to the conclusion, is really good for a Zoom session. Do be careful with assigning required synchronous sessions, because you may have students who are in different states or even different continents who may be in a wildly different time zone than you are. So we need to just make sure that we're being considerate of those students and their needs in terms of when the session is scheduled. So this one is a little bit more simplistic than the asynchronous style, so we already can get into the do's and don'ts for this. In the do column, I would suggest having an agenda for each synchronous session. It's not something that you necessarily have to share with students, but it is a good tool for you as the instructor and the facilitator of the synchronous discussion, so that you know what are your main points, what are the major things that you need to highlight in this synchronous Zoom time. That way, as you're going through the session, if things get a little bit off track, you know when you need to speed up or slow down and things like that. It's helpful to have any files or documents that you need already pulled up and ready to go. That way, while you have the synchronous session going, you're not losing time trying to find your PowerPoints and find your handouts and things like that. For these classes that are online, especially with new learners and with very large groups of learners, it's very important to set rules and guidelines for your synchronous sessions, especially if you have webcams and or mics enabled. I know it feels like we've been doing this for a really long time now, but it is still very easy to forget a lot of the tips and tricks of Zooms. I still have moments where I don't realize I'm muted and I start talking. So I know students who are taking six classes can certainly have those moments where they forget about their webcam or they forget about their mic. So it's really good to go ahead and just have those guidelines at the beginning of your session as a reminder. If you are screen sharing with your students, it's important to have your computer notifications, such as your email or anything like that, muted, and to remind your students to do the same, because those notification sounds that your email makes will come through the computer audio, and it can be a little bit distracting, especially if students are trying to talk to each other in the Zoom session. It's usually a good idea to test your technology prior to the meeting time. Zoom has a personal meeting room function, if you've never used that before, where you can just actually pull up a private room that just has you in it. You can invite other people into it if you want to, but you don't have to. And that's a good technique for making sure all of your settings are working. So for example, let's say you want to have live captions active during your synchronous Zoom session. you can just pull up your personal meeting room and you can see whether or not that is working and whether or not you have all of the correct settings active. So it's really useful for testing things like that. And finally, just like with the asynchronous tools, you want to link to tech support for whatever synchronous tool you are using to have your synchronous discussion. In the don't column, similar with the asynchronous discussion, make sure that you don't have any sensitive student information or your private information pulled up on your computer while you are having synchronous sessions. It's very easy if you want to screen share to accidentally click on the wrong tab, and you don't want to fall into a situation where you have students' grades pulled up and you accidentally screen share them to the whole class. Or, you know, maybe you were doing banking right before you had to host your session. You don't want students to be able to see all that information. So when in doubt, it's just better to not have that stuff pulled up when you're about to get into a synchronous session. One thing I like to suggest, because, you know, we've had a few instances with Zoom. I know you've probably read about these online with different Zoom disasters and things that are distracting during meetings and whatnot. I would suggest not to ignore those, even though it can be, you know, really awkward and uncomfortable to point that out if that happens during your synchronous sessions. You can practice from an instructor standpoint, muting people and turning off people's webcams, and that will help you if any sort of situation like that pops up where somebody forgot to turn off their webcam or their microphone. That actually happened in my virtual graduation. Someone left their microphone on and I believe they were on hold with, and you could just hear the hold music blasting through the computer. And when that happens, you know, it can really detract from the synchronous session. So you can just go in as the instructor and mute them and it will be all good. And lastly, I know this is really hard because we are all super busy and having to juggle so many tasks at once, but try not to do other tasks while you are presenting. I know it kind of feels like when we're in this virtual setting where we can't really fully see each other in the same room, that it's not noticeable. But if I were to look at my phone, for example, I'm doing this, and you can tell that I am doing something else while I am trying to present. That's something that can just, you know, be distracting to your viewers and kind of give a little bit of an impression of lacking engagement. So we just want to avoid doing that and stay focused on the synchronous discussion agenda. So a quick note on grading. This is something that, as I mentioned before, different types of discussion and grading is going to be appropriate for different fields and different topics. There are so many different ways you can quantify it depending on what works well for you. Whatever you decide to do, again, just making sure your instructions are very clear is very, very important. And modeling what those instructions look like in a sample response can be really helpful if your students are still confused. I have a few examples of some of the little grading tips you can use. You could tell students that they need to answer all parts of the question. You could tell them they need to post at least 2 responses and 2 comments and others' posts. You could give them a word count. You could tell them the number of times per week that they need to post. And if you're trying to clarify what a good post looks like, a phrase that I tend to go back to whenever I'm creating discussion questions is substantial posts should expand upon other posts and or ask questions, avoid good job or I agree. And that just, again, lets students know what a good post that's going to get them full credit will look like. So now we're going to talk a little bit about some online discussion technology before we get into our first activity for the day. And I have a couple of options on here. Some of these you have free access to in general, or you have free access to them as an instructor or student at FSU. The first two, of course, are Canvas and Zoom. I will say that Canvas, I love the discussion board function that is integrated into the learning management system. It doesn't work great for trying to have a synchronous discussion because students have to constantly refresh the page in order to see new responses. And, you know, that can just get a little bit tedious and they can get confused as to where they are in the thread. So I would personally suggest mainly using Canvas as your asynchronous discussion tool. Zoom, as we discussed, really good for different types of synchronous discussion. Just be careful with when you schedule it and how you make it required, depending on what time zones your students are in. Google Docs and Google Slides are really cool tools. If you've never used them before, they're essentially like online versions of a Word document or a PowerPoint presentation. But the reason they work really well for these collaborative type activities is because if you give your students sharing privileges to, or excuse me, editing privileges by sharing the link with them, they are able to make changes to the document or to the PowerPoint presentation in real time. So for example, if you all were to log into one of my Google Docs, you could actually see what I'm typing as I'm typing it. So this is really cool. It gets around that problem of having to constantly refresh the page to see what other people have done. And it's good not only for if you want to use this to have people talk to each other, but if you want to have people work on some kind of group project, then they'll be able to see what everyone else is doing and not type over other people. So that's really handy. You can also use different blogging platforms for projects and discussions in your class. I've had classes before where the blog was actually a project within the class, and each student had to maintain a weekly blog while responding to others' comments on their blog. So it was kind of a neat combination of a discussion platform and a project that was ongoing throughout the semester. So that's a cool option if you want to get creative with it. Then we have Flipgrid, which if you've never used that, it's a really neat video recording tool that you can integrate into your Canvas site. Essentially, it allows people to record brief videos. At the moment, it has a maximum of 10-minute long videos where you log in. You can either record a webcam video where you're just talking into the webcam, or you can upload a PowerPoint presentation and do a voice over that. You post it on the Flipgrid page, and it arranges all of the different videos in a grid shape. So people can go through and they can click on whichever topics interest them and watch those videos. And then they can post video or text responses to those questions. So it's kind of a cool asynchronous method for replicating the face-to-face style of discussion, because, you know, even though students aren't in the same room with each other and they may be participating at different times throughout the week, their peers can go onto their video and record a webcam video response to whatever they posted. So it's kind of cool if they are missing that face-to-face interaction with their peers. And the last one that I want to touch upon, because this is what we're going to be using for our first activity today, is Padlet. The best way I can describe Padlet is, there's also polls, excuse me, and we're going to use that in a later activity today. And that's something that's really, really neat that you can do directly within Zoom. But with Padlet, picture one of those corkboard message boards that people like to put notes and photos and important documentation and things on in their house or in their office. Padlet is essentially a digital version of that, where people can go in and they make little post-it notes and they just stick it on the Padlet space. The post-it notes could be just text that they've written down. They can share images, they can share links, they can do so many different things. Here I just have an idea of the different posts you might see. You might see one person asking questions, someone else sharing an idea, another person giving a critique on something, and yet someone else sharing a resource. So it's very versatile in terms of what students are allowed to share in this one space. There are also a few options where if you enable these, students can link concepts to one another. So let's say you have one student's post and another student's post, and they want to show how their posts, how the concepts in those posts are linked together. There's one option where you can actually drag threads in between the different posts students make. So it's interesting if you want your students to be able to draw those connections. But without further ado, I would like to actually dive into using this tool. So instructions for this activity. When you log into the Padlet, and all you have to do is click this link, which we will put in the chat shortly. It'll take you to the Padlet space. You'll see a post that's already in the space, and it says has all of the discussion prompts that you can choose from. There are several options, and I would like for you to choose a minimum of two of these prompts to respond to. You don't have to respond to all of them. The goal of this is to actually practice that multiple prompt style discussion and to choose what you find most interesting as a learner to respond to. Then you'll respond to at least two other participants' posts in a meaningful manner. If none of the questions appeal to you, you're also welcome to just ask your own question for people to engage with in the discussion. So I'm going to stop this screen share really quick. Thank you, Fong, for posting that. The link should be posted in the Zoom chat now, and I'll quickly show you what you should be seeing when you log in. Okay. So you should see this discussions on discussion Padlet page when you click on the link. Just click on this Google Doc link to have access to the different prompts and go ahead and start posting and responding. I'm going to give about 15 minutes for this activity, and then we will come back as a group and reconvene. I'm going to go ahead and turn my webcam off and my microphone just so I'm not sitting here staring at you while you're trying to do this, but I'm not going anywhere. I will be present if you have any questions or concerns. Bring everybody back into the session. You all did a wonderful job posting in the Padlet forum. I saw some really great conversation, and I wanted to highlight a couple of the themes that I saw. One was people who talked mainly about synchronous discussion, talked about how it's nice that it more closely mirrors the typical face-to-face discussions we would be having in our face-to-face classrooms. It feels a little bit more natural, and it gives students the chance to expand upon points when they can see the person they're talking to and can do it in real time, as opposed to, you know, posting one post that can't really be easily edited after the fact. And this is a really good point. And I do think that when possible, it's good to have at least a couple of synchronous sessions with your students so that they can get over some of that isolation that I think a lot of us are feeling in the online environment and see you, see their instructor, and see some of their peers in the synchronous space. For asynchronous discussion, a lot of people touched upon the fact that it gives students a chance to really carefully think about what they want to say and what interests them. And it's really helpful for students who are a little bit more timid and might be nervous to speak up in front of class. And I definitely relate to this one. I was that student in class who would rehearse what I wanted to say 20 times before I finally got up the courage to say something. So that allows for students who do have that little timid nature to sort of thrive in that asynchronous discussion space because they have the time to carefully plan out what they want to say. I also saw a couple of comments about using the multiple prompt style and how it's interesting that it lets students actually choose what is interesting to them about the topics, which again, that's why I love that style so much, because it encourages them to explore whatever stands out to them about the content as an independent learner. And lastly, I saw a couple of posts that brought up a really important concern, which is when you have an asynchronous discussion, it can get really difficult if all of the students in the class post at the very last minute at the end of the week, and then everybody has to rush and try to give peer responses to those posts. That is definitely a concern that happens quite frequently. And the way that you can avoid that is by setting a couple of different deadlines. You can set a deadline earlier in the week where students have to post that initial post, and then you could set a deadline at the end of the week for them to post their peer responses. And that will essentially, it forces students to make an initial post so that a discussion can happen throughout the week, as opposed to putting it off until the deadline. So thank you so much for engaging with that activity. And I am now going to share the PowerPoint again, and I will turn it over to Dr. Luceno.
Thank you, Katie. All right. So is everybody ready to get into some polling? Polling is fun. I love polling. Okay, so let's talk about some real-time interactive technologies. And as I already mentioned, polling is one of those technologies. Now, if you've been a student for a while or a teacher for a while, I'm sure you're aware of the iClicker and the Reef technology, you know, the old-fashioned now, I guess they're old-fashioned, the actual physical clickers that we all used to use, which I'm sure some people still use. Of course, now we have the online apps that a lot of people use, teachers and students. So iClicker and Reef, I believe, Reef is the iClicker version, or I mean, is the app version, I think, of iClicker. Turning technology is another one. Poll Everywhere, Poll Junkie, Kahoot, and I know there's others as well, have some free apps, which is awesome. And then Zoom now has the polls integrated into Zoom that we can use, and we're actually going to use them. And I'm going to demonstrate how I use them when I teach my philosophy classes, my intro to philosophy classes. So, well, you know what? Before I go on, I wanted to stop and give you a chance to ask any questions of Katie or I, but I just started, before we move on. Did you have any questions? Anybody have a question? I didn't see anybody in chat. But, you know, with the discussion boards, with what Katie just showed you, with Padlet? No? Okay, if you do, you can put it in chat or raise your hand or just start talking, unmute yourself. Okay, well, I'll just move ahead then. So I want to show you again how I use Zoom polls in my class, but I've also used the old fashioned, you know, variety of clickers too, in order to do what I'm going to show you in order to have a classroom discussion. Next slide, please, Katie. Okay, so I'm going to show you, you can go ahead and put it all up, Katie, if you want at once. It's fine, even though I had put it bit by bit. So I'm going to show you a teaching methodology I use in conjunction with polling equipment, whether it be the old fashioned equipment or the apps or the Zoom polling. And this I stole. So as all good teachers do, in my opinion, we steal from each other. So this is from a Harvard professor, Dr. Eric Mazur, M-A-Z-U-R. Some of you may have heard of him because he's very famous for using this type of teaching methodology with polling. He's a physics professor at Harvard. And he came up with this specific methodology. So of course I want to give him credit. And it's a combination of ways to engage your students in the classroom with different modes of learning and teaching. So let's go through the steps that are used, and it might look like a lot of steps, but believe me, it's not intricate. And it's a way to really get your students engaged. And that's what I love about it. And me, right? Me as a professor, of course, we want to be engaged as teachers too. We want to have fun when we're in the classroom. And we want our students to do too as well. Classroom isn't about just having fun, but in my opinion, I think, you know, it's important to make learning fun. So if we can, as much as we can. So here's the methodology. Number one, the first step is come up with a question. So come up with a question that you can use in your classroom to get students to think about the concepts or the ideas that you're explaining to them, that you're teaching to them, and have it go, going back to Bloom's taxonomy, try and aim for those higher levels of learning with that question. Think about when you were learning that subject matter, what got you tripped up? What maybe made you a little confused about that concept you're trying to teach them? What's a common misconception people have? Or if you can't think of anything that really tripped you up, what is it that you really want to, what's one of the points you really want to make about that concept? And make that into the subject of the question. So you're going to ask your students a question with a polling, right? So you want to have it aim, what I'm going to show you is an application question. Okay, I'm going to apply the theory to a scenario. One of my favorite things to do is using a scenario. Now, I know no matter, you know, it depends on what your subject matter is. With, you know, the sciences, it might not be so easy, but I will tell you, my friends over in biology, I don't know, I think Melanie might be on here. There's some folks in biology that I know use polling very often, right? And physics too, by the way, obviously, Dr. Mazur is physics. Okay, so first come up with a question. Secondly, allow your students time to individually think about this question and what their answer is individually. And then you poll them individually, okay? So third, you poll them. You have them commit to an answer. This is individually. The next step is have them find a classmate that doesn't agree with their answer, okay? So you have you find someone hopefully sitting near you when we can do that again post-pandemic. Or what I'm gonna do is put you in breakout rooms and hopefully somebody in your breakout room will disagree with you, okay? That's the hope. You find somebody that disagrees with you and then you try to convince them why you're right, okay? So I'm in a room with Katie. Katie disagrees with me. I say, Katie, with all due respect, I think I'm right. I think you're wrong. And more importantly, this is why I think I'm right. So what you're doing is justifying your answer. And then Katie will do the same for me. She will say, well, Lisa, I think you're wrong. No offense, but I'm going to explain to you why I think I'm right and you're wrong, okay? So that's where we get the peer-to-peer teaching. So peer teaching is really a wonderful way to get students engaged. And remember, that's really important in discussions because students are basically around the same level of background learning, not all the time. But you know, we've been, as teachers, we've been studying our discipline for years, right? Sometimes it's hard for us to remember what it's like to be learning about our discipline for the, you know, the first time or within the first couple of years as an undergrad. So peer-to-peer learning is really, really a good way for them to not only get to know other people, but also be able to really figure these things out when they're at the similar stages in the learning cycle. Okay, then come back, I'll bring you back out of your breakout rooms, and I'll re-poll you on the same question I asked initially. And what that is meant to see, okay, did that peer-to-peer discussion change your mind? Okay, did she change my mind? Did she convince me she's right and I'm wrong? Okay, so we'll re-poll and see if anybody's, you know, how many people changed their answers. And then the last step is explanation. So have some of the students here, we could have some of you explain and defend your answers and explain what you think the answer is. And again, more importantly, why? Not only what your answer is, but why your answer is what it is. And then the instructor can actually come out and say what the right answer is and why. So that's a whole process that allows, again, so many different types of modes of thinking and learning for your students. Do you have any questions about this methodology? You could also really do it without polling. It's just polling really makes it easier. It's fun to see, you know, people's answers. It's fun to see, you know, how many change and that type of thing. So we're actually going to do this now. Next slide, Katie. Okay, so yeah, you can just put the whole thing up. So now I'm gonna virtually take you into one of my freshman philosophy classrooms. This is an actual slide from my class in Intro to Philosophy, Intro Ethics. Okay, so in these classes, I teach my students about utilitarianism, and I'm sure you've probably heard of utilitarianism. It's a moral, ethical moral theory that according to which, oops, did I just do something?
Sorry about that. I was trying to respond to something.
Oh, I was going to say, did I do that or? Okay.
Here we go.
Okay. Thank you. It's a moral, utilitarianism is simply a moral theory in which the morally right action is that which produces the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people. And this is actually the moral theory that we tend to use in society quite often. So a lot of times we decide the right thing to do is the thing that will produce the greatest amount of good, here the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest number of people involved. Now, according to utilitarianism, happiness is really the same thing as pleasure or the absence of pain. Okay, but just remember that it's the greatest amount of happiness or good for the greatest number of people. And there's six factors. Actually, I think there's seven, Katie. I think there's one more. Yep, quality. Okay, so just quickly, I know this isn't an actual philosophy class, so I just want to, you know, quickly go through these factors with you. You count every person equally. So because I'm me doesn't mean I can count me any more important than you. Okay. If you're my daughter, I can't count you any more important than anybody else. So we're all in this calculation, we're all count for the same level of importance. So we count every person equally important. We calculate the net overall amount of pleasure or happiness that would result from an action. This is a consequentialist theory, and that the consequences matter to determine what's the morally right act to do. Okay. The intensity of the happiness matters. So the more intense the happiness that results from an action, the better than the less intensity that could, you know, result from a different action. The duration of the happiness matters. So an act that produces a longer duration of happiness would be more morally right than one that produces a less duration of happiness or amount of time it lasts. Fruitfulness, what are the long-term results of that action's happiness? That action which produces a result that has more long-term happiness that comes from it is better than the alternative. The likelihood, what are the chances of that act's consequences of happiness actually happening? Okay, you take that into account. And then the quality of the happiness. No, I'm not going to get too much into that because if you are actually taking my class, that's one of the key factors is the quality of the happiness that we talk about. Okay, so what's the quality of the pleasure? So in other words, one of the biggest, you know, examples we use is the happiness, the quality that I get from listening to Mozart is a different type of quality from eating a gummy bear or something like that, right? That quality differs, the type of happiness. Okay, so these are the seven factors that we use to determine, according to utilitarianism, which act is the morally right act. Any questions on that quickly? Again, knowing this is not actually a philosophy class. And with my class, I'd actually take a lot longer going through this. So this is just, you know, of course, to give you an example. Next slide, Katie, please. Okay. All right, so let's test your knowledge about utilitarianism here. So this is what I would do in my class. going on to the, you know, the next step of polling. So I want you to think individually first, and then I'm going to open the poll. Okay, so this is an application scenario. I've explained utilitarianism to you. Now I want you to apply it to this scenario. Consider the two cases. While lying by a lake, Lance sees a drowning child in the water. Normally, Lance would be too preoccupied with getting a tan to care about rescuing a child. In this case, however, he notices an attractive woman, apparently unable to swim, shouting for someone to help the child. Hoping to impress the woman, Lance jumps into the water and saves the child. Okay, that's scenario one. Scenario two, while lying by a lake, John sees a drowning child. Although he's a poor swimmer, John is terrified by the prospect of the child drowning. So therefore, with the welfare of the child being his top concern, John jumps into the water and saves the child. Okay, so those are two separate cases or scenarios. Now, in order to test my students' knowledge of utilitarianism, I ask them, according to utilitarianism, which one of the following is true? Lance does the morally right thing, John does the morally right thing, both do the morally right thing, or neither does. Now remember, this isn't your opinion about who does the morally right thing. This is utilitarian, the theory of utilitarianism, what, according to that theory of morally right actions, who does the morally right thing, or do both or neither? So given that, I'm gonna open the poll. And remember, you're not actually in my class, so this is just a demonstration of how you can use polling and questioning in your class. So I'm gonna launch the poll. Oh boy, it says it's not working. Oh, okay, you can see it. I don't know why it said it wasn't working. I'll give you another minute. And remember, you're not actually in my philosophy class, so you're not being tested. And it's fine if you don't get it right or whatever. It's just showing you how you can use it, how you can use this technique in your classes. We have quite a few more people to, it says 14 of you have voted. Got three more people. I'll just give you another 10 seconds and then I'll end it. Maybe everybody has, because it might be counting like Katie and me and, well, I don't think it's counting me, but all right, I'll just end it and we'll see who said what. So can you see the results? You can't? Oh, you can, okay. So let's see, so it looks like the majority of you said Lance, but you still have people that said both coming up very close second. Okay. So now I'm gonna just for like 5 minutes. I mean, I'm not gonna do this for long, because again, this is just showing you how this works. I'm gonna put you, Katie, I think you're gonna have to do it because you're the host. Do you wanna put them, or do you wanna make me the host? Put them into breakout groups?
Sure, I will do that. I'm also going to stop my screen share, and I'm going to put a link to a Google Doc with this scenario in the chat, so that if you need to read it again or look at the options again, you can. Because once we go into breakout rooms, you won't be able to see the screen share anymore.
Okay, so remember, we're just I'm just showing you this methodology. So next, I will put you in breakout groups. And remember, just ask around and see, maybe take a quick vote, see if people disagree about your answers. And even if you don't, just talk about your answers and why you think the answer is what it is. Okay. And then we'll bring you back. We'll only leave you in there like 5 minutes. I don't want to take a chunk of time. Katie, like she said, in the chat, she'll put the link, or I guess you already have. Or you haven't?
I have.
You can opt out. Somebody asked if they can opt out. Yeah, you can opt out.
I'm not going to make you do it. You can stay in the main room here with us. We'll just... sorry, I'm trying to make sure we have enough people.
Yeah, you can just ignore the invitation to the breakout room if you don't want to do it.
Yep.
Okay. But we'll give you just a few minutes to talk to each other about your answer, just so you can live through the process.
Let me just make sure we have enough people. Okay.
Thank you, Katie.
Of course.
Did I explain it okay so far? Oh, you know the answer, you're saying, huh? Have you taken a philosophy class, or you just, you could go, wait, no, I'm doing a poll next, right? Had I shared the results for you all? Did you see the results?
Yes.
Okay.
Shall I relaunch the polling now?
Yeah, just a second about that. Okay. Okay, I know somebody's got to leave. All right, well, welcome back. I hope you had fun talking to each other. Now we're going to relaunch the poll, because this is the second polling, and see if you've changed your mind at all. So we're gonna relaunch the poll. So go ahead and answer again. Remember, Lance is the one that was too busy tanning to normally, worry about a drowning kid, but wants to impress the woman. John is a bad swimmer, but nonetheless, figures he needs to help. He doesn't even think twice. Okay, and it looks like most of you, a couple of you are still answering, but most of you have answered, and I know we're getting close on time. So, so it looks like there is some change because a lot of you are saying both now, which is tied with Lance. Interesting. Okay, so either, okay, let's, are you showing it? Yeah, are you able to see it right now? Okay, so it looks like there has been some change, which is very common, that there's some change in answers after you've talked to each other. Okay, so then the last step is to, and we don't have really any time for this, but normally I would have my students offer, some of you offer to speak about what you think and why you think it. And then I would, as the instructor, explain the reasoning behind the answer that is the correct one. Okay, so since we don't have a lot of time, I'll switch it over to Katie.
Before I take over, do we get to know what the answer is to that question?
Okay, that's funny. Every time I use this as an example, people want to know the answer. And I always say, but why do you care, right? Because what I'm showing you here is a method to use in your classes, right? To get your students engaged. But how many of you want to know the answer?
We're invested.
This is perfect. And see, this is exactly why this is such an awesome methodology to use in your classes. Because look, you're engaged, you care, but this isn't a philosophy class, right? So quickly, I'll tell you, on the basic reading of utilitarianism, Lance would be the correct answer. Because, of course, even though, and this is the important point about utilitarianism, it doesn't take into account intentions of the actor. So his intentions don't matter. It's the consequence, right? His character doesn't matter because it's the consequences of the action. And that's one of the big points that I was saying when I come up with a question for my class that I want to drive home, is that the character and the intentions of the actor really don't matter. Now, I'm not going to get into it because I know there's a lot of time. However, people that defend utilitarianism say, because of that factor number 7 about quality of happiness, that you can actually argue against that answer and say, you know, that actually John in the long run would produce more happiness because he's a good person, and that girl is going to find out Lance is a jerk. And so it would end up with, you know, unhappiness in the long run. So there's ways to argue around that answer if you really delve into utilitarianism. But on the face of it, because of the lack of concern about intention and the actor's character, it's Lance. So I'm glad you're invested, and hopefully that shows you that that technique is a really cool technique to use in your classrooms. And a lot of it is allowing the students to do all the work, which is, I'm another big fan of as an instructor. Let your students do the work, right? Because that's how they learn. The biggest problem is, well, not a problem, but the biggest amount of work you have to do is coming up with a really good question. So if anybody has a question, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I'll flip it back over to Katie.
I do want to address a question that came up a little earlier in the chat, since I know we're running short on time, because it actually goes along with the theme of the slide we're on now. And that is, when you're having a discussion, how do you prevent that discussion from turning into a full-on debate? This sort of ties into whenever you have discussions on sensitive topics in class. I'm not going to get too much into detail on this specific topic of discussion because we're actually going to try to devote an entire workshop with speakers on this topic at some point. But, you know, it gets a little tricky when you get into this type of discussion where, you know, the topics are particularly sensitive or emotionally charged in nature. And it really becomes a sort of balancing act, right? Because you have all these different people with different identities coming from different backgrounds in your classroom. And you have to find the balance between giving them the freedom to share those perspectives and at the same time facilitating and enforcing an environment of respect and civility among these individuals who may have different perspectives. And there are a couple of things that you can do to prevent things like debates breaking out in your classroom. When I say debate, I don't mean debates as in the healthy type of debate where people are sharing evidence and contrasting viewpoints. I more mean arguments where civility is starting to fail. So one thing you can always do is include a civility statement in your syllabus that just reminds them of the rules they are expected to follow as they interact with one another in the classroom. If you have particularly sensitive topics in your content, it might be helpful to provide trigger warnings in your syllabus if needed and list campus support resources for students. But above all, one thing that we often do in the PI book clubs, for example, is at the beginning of the session, set ground rules. So you can have general civility tenets that everyone is expected to follow. You can have your class create a contract for how they will interact with one another in the discussion boards or in synchronous discussion. And one thing that's pretty cool that you can do with that is you can actually get input from your students about the types of tenets they would like to follow and would like to see in terms of civility and having productive discussions. I do see there's something in the chat, so I'm just going to quickly look at that. Oh yes, thank you for coming, Megan. So to address that question overall that came in earlier about preventing those debates, just making sure you set some ground rules and ensure that students adhere to those can really be helpful for you. That way students will know what the behavior expectations are. So the last slide here, because I know we are out of time, is what if my students just simply won't talk? You've tried just about everything you can think of and you're still having trouble getting students to engage with the discussion. The first thing that I think is really important to remember is that there are many reasons for silence. I don't want, you know, anyone to leave here and start a discussion and feel like they're not doing it correctly or anything along those lines. There are so many reasons why your students might not be engaging. They could be very introverted and prefer to watch and listen to others talk while they process the information. They could have anxiety about being in class and having to speak in front of a lot of people. You could have students who English is not their first language and they're not as comfortable speaking up in the discussion. So many different reasons. I really like this one quote that I've pasted on the slide, which is a guy in class got called on to answer a question. And after a short pause, he says, "Hang on, I'm not dumb, I'm just panicking." And that's something that can happen, you know, when put, you can have all these great thoughts about what the discussion is, and then you get called on to speak and it just, you can just freeze. It happens to a lot of people. So a couple of things you can do to try to combat these situations when students aren't talking and engaging. You can try using that multiple prompt style to try to get their individual interests involved in the discussion. You can use interactive new tools if maybe they're getting bored with Canvas and Zoom and they want to try something new. That's something you can do. You might even poll them and figure out if there is a large interest in trying some sort of new discussion technology. You can ask them low stakes questions throughout the class period and call on quiet students if you need to. And by low stakes questions, I mean, for example, let's say you're discussing a particular concept. You might ask a student, "What do you think about this? What is your opinion?" You know, share your thoughts. And that type of question tends to make people feel like, well, they're asking me what I think. They're not asking what the right answer is, you know, and it can take off a good bit of the pressure. And it could also, you know, for one thing, make them feel like their opinion and their perspective is valid. And for another, it just, again, it makes them feel like they're not trying to, you know, impress the instructor or give a particular right answer. Now, on the flip side, some students may panic a little bit if they are asked what their opinion is. Same thing does not work for all people, but that's where we get into, above all, reading your audience and figuring out what works well for them, because all classes have different groups of people. If all else fails, the thing I would like to suggest is to set really strong guidelines for participation. So, you know, in breakout rooms, if you're using those, maybe you tell them that all participants, when you come back to the room, have to contribute one idea, and that will essentially force them to engage with the discussion. With the asynchronous discussions, you could set really clear, rigid guidelines and give examples if students are having trouble engaging there. And then it's also possible that throughout the semester, they'll get more and more proficient at having these online discussions, and eventually they won't need such rigid guidelines. So at this point, I'm going to open up the floor for questions. I know we are at least 6 minutes over time, but if you have anything for me, I am more than happy to answer.
There's a question in the chat area, Katie, if you'd like to answer. It's about, with the pandemic in consideration, many students are facing mental health and motivation issues. How can you cater a class and activities to be mindful of this transition into a purely online format, since it has been difficult for many students to be on top of classwork or engage?
That's a really good question. And that's something that you know, I wish I had a one size fits all answer for, but I know, again, people are coming from so many different challenges over the past year leading into 2021. But, you know, one thing I would be sure to establish in the classroom when dealing with this type of issue is, you know, make sure your students know that they can come to you, whether it's in office hours or, you know, via emailing you, whatever the case may be, and let you know whatever struggle they may be facing. Let them know that it's better for them to be communicative with you throughout the semester as opposed to waiting till the end to let you know that they were struggling and having these problems that were interfering with their ability to perform well in the class. Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt at all. Did you finish your idea?
Yeah, that was the end.
I was gonna say, I would also suggest providing different methods of engagement and participation, especially to lower that stress level. So again, going back to the different styles that students have about how outgoing they are. So providing a variety of ways for them to engage and participate. So for those who are shy and are going through a lot of mental health concerns, maybe more take-home participation options and giving them an ability to choose the whole class. Of course, you have to do that for the whole class unless they are giving you documentation to allow an alternative format just for them. But think about that, especially as you put together your syllabus, allowing a variety that they could choose from ways to participate, maybe a short response paper, or maybe, you know, in-class discussion so that they can demonstrate discussion in different ways, in different varieties of ways. That's a way to also think about it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And there's another question here. Should teachers have mental health check-ins? Would this be helpful? That is actually a really good idea. One thing that I will tell you I've had instructors do before, because you do have to be careful, especially as a TA, you cannot put yourself in the role of counselor or mental health professional as the instructor. But one thing that I have had instructors do that I found really helpful in my online classes is at different points during the semester, sometimes at the halfway point, sometimes, you know, every other month, depending on how frequently you feel your students could use a check-in, they would just send a private email to each student saying, hey, how are you doing in the class? Do you have any concerns? Do you have anything you need to bring to my attention? What are you liking so far? What do you dislike? Just a very, you know, friendly, open to discussion email that each student receives with their name on it personally. I never had instructors, you know, send out the same blanket email to everyone, so it feels a little bit more personal. And that will give them the opportunity to let you know, hey, I'm having this trouble with technology, I'm having this trouble with my schedule, I'm feeling overwhelmed. And then you as the instructor can decide, do you need to refer them to those campus resources? Is there a common issue that is occurring with technology or with the coursework throughout the class that maybe you need to address with all students? Sending that check-in email while avoiding coming across as it being sort of a mental health check-in, just calling it a general check-in email, is a way to do that without falling into the trap of basically trying to serve as a mental health professional.
Yeah, as Nathaniel put, do not do this in the context. I'm sure, Nathaniel, and feel free to unmute yourself if you want to explain further. I would say, yes, not ever frame it as a mental health check-in. And the reason why is exactly what Katie's saying, because we're not mental health experts, but even if we are, that's not our position as an instructor. What is our position, though, is to connect them with the correct resources. Absolutely, absolutely. So as an ACE instructor, and actually that's gonna be the our whole next workshop, please attend and let other people know, because we're going to have those campus resources available, some of them that will be the ones that you refer them to. But of course, if you are concerned they have mental health issues, or if they come to you with them, please do refer them to the counseling center, of course. And depending on the degree, I mean, if it's serious at the moment, and you can even ask, are you considering harming yourself? And if that's the case, you want to take care of that immediately, mm-hmm. even if you have to call the campus police to, have them come. So that is something that we always have to be on the lookout for, but we don't want to ever say, and I know, Shelley, I don't think you meant it that way, but to say, I'm going to do a mental health check-in, like Katie said, just do a check-in. And yes, do check-ins, please. Check in on your students, because they want to know somebody cares, of course.
They will appreciate it so much, and it will help reduce them feeling isolated when they can't see you every other day in the classroom. That's a great question. Thank you so much for bringing that up. That's so important.
Yeah, thank you, Shelley. And we know that you didn't mean it that way, but I'm glad that it came up, because then everybody knows mm-hmm. how to frame it.
Thank you for answering my question. Sorry if it came off that way, but in regards to like, oh, is the class load appropriate, or do you feel overwhelmed by the amount of discussion posts you have to do? You know, framing it in that sort of sense, because I know, like, I'm currently a grad student and transitioning completely to online while living at home, and that absence of a sort of routine or structure can be, I know it's been difficult on me, and it can be really difficult on other students. So as someone who's trying to get an assistantship or be a TA, I would love to know how I could help, people be more compassionate about what's going on with the pandemic and how it is really affecting students from a student's perspective.
Mm-hmm.